This is episode 51 of the Blind Sport Podcast, entitled Can Echolocation Help Your Sport? With Daniel Kish.
Welcome to the Blind Sport Podcast, with your host, Mike Lloyd.
He's a Kiwi, but he can't help it, eh? Sorry, we tried to get a rich and famous good-looking athlete, but they were all busy.
I can actually hear you guys.
Oops. Big ears.
Brought to you by www.theblindsportpodcast.com.
This is the dedicated sports podcast for the blind, the partially sighted and even the supported sighty. Building a global community around blind sport.
It's great to have you on the team.
Hi, I'm Mike, and this is the Blind Sport Podcast, the sports show for the blind, the partially sighted, and the supportive sighty. Thanks for joining me for episode 51. On the show, we'll be speaking to Daniel Kish from California and asking the question, can echolocation help your sport? We quite often comment on how spatial awareness plays a big part on how we approach various sports. So how much more could you do, or how much better could you be, if you learnt the skill of echolocation? Hi there, I hope this episode finds you fit and well. Before we chat to Daniel about echolocation, I would like to thank you for the feedback received re episode 50, where I reflected back on my recent New York City Marathon experience. Some of the comments that I received included, from Samantha, I have never run a marathon, but this episode made me want to. From Jess, thanks for sharing your New York Marathon story and reminding us that with action, dreams can be achieved. But without action, they remain nothing but a wish. Please email me with any comments.
To contact Mike or comment on the Blind Sport Podcast,
submit a feedback form from the website of blindsportpodcast.com.
Email Mike at theblindsportpodcast.com.
Send a tweet or follow us on Twitter at blindsportmike.
Or visit the Blind Sport Podcast page on Facebook.
Echolocation is a technique where making repeated click sounds with your mouth and then listening to how that sound is reflected off your surrounding environment can allow you to get a mental picture of where you are and what's around you. Daniel Kish has spent his entire life using this tool to interpret his surroundings, live independently, and possibly interact with the world in a very different way than many blind or vision impaired people.
At first glance, this may seem like an ordinary man out for an ordinary bike ride. Daniel Kish is completely blind, so how does he know where he's going? Or how to avoid oncoming traffic? The answer can be found in the clicking sound you hear. It's called echolocation. Bats use it to fly around in the dark, and dolphins use it to navigate the oceans. Daniel uses echolocation, or sound, to see.
Daniel Kish, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Brilliant. Can you just start by telling us a little bit about your childhood and your initial sight loss and how you discovered the whole echolocation concept, really?
I was born with retinoblastoma, which are retinal tumors. I lost my first eye at the age of 7 months and the second at 13 months. And I was from what my parents tell me, I was clicking probably by the age of 15 to 18 months and finding my way around. It looked to them as though I had sort of found a way to see what was around me, but my eyes had been removed. So, I mean, there was no There's no possibility of that literally happening. As far as my own memories go, I can remember back to about the age of 2, 2.5. And I remember climbing out of my bedroom window and wandering around the neighborhood, basically, bored from not being able to sleep. This would have happened around midnight or so. I think the development of this really came out of the way my parents raised me and the attitude in which they raised me. I was really free to discover my surroundings and discover my own relationship with my surroundings without having that relationship dictated by others. So it was kind of, what is my world and how do I understand it? And I think that in my case, that helped me to kind of develop the tools to really see that world in a way that allowed me to relate to it in on rather friendly terms.
So before we get too in-depth into how it affected you growing up, can you just give us a general synopsis of how it works as such?
It's a traditional sonar, so it really is like bat sonar. Bats are actually the best comparison because they use airborne sonar. So in my case, I would click with my tongue and the resulting sound would go out and it would, scientists like to say it would irradiate the environment with energy, and that energy will bounce from surfaces, light energy, sound energy, it all bounces. So it bounces from surfaces, comes back to me, and my brain interprets the pattern of reflections based on the way the sound comes back. So it's kind of like sound waves essentially returning with actual impressions of the surfaces that they encounter. And you hear those impressions and you extract information to form an image. So I like to call it three-dimensional fuzzy geometry. You get depth of structure or texture, density. You get dimension. You get the contours of items that are around you, and you get the relationships among those items. And then, you know, if you're in a large area, you get distance. So a strong click will carry for 50 meters or so. And then, you know, if you clap your hands and you're able to issue a sharp report, that will travel for hundreds of meters.
So the area I was going to focus on, obviously, for this podcast is in the relationship that has with sport and recreational activities. How did this concept affect the way you grew up and your relationship with sport?
I was very physical as a kid, and I think that was partly my personality anyway. I was into stuff, and...
One of those kids, eh?
I was into stuff, and I was on stuff. So, I mean, my thing was climbing, and actually climbing is kind of endemic to blind children, in much the way that running around after a ball is for sighted kids. And so we make a big mistake by restricting kids from climbing, because that's, in my experience, a rather natural thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very physical, visceral thing to do. It's a real way to relate to your environment. So I was a climber and always have been. So tree climbing was a big, big thing to me. And an important thing to me. I was given a bicycle when I was 6 or 7.
Okay.
And I had taught myself already how to ride. That's why my dad brought the bike home,
mm-hmm.
is I had learned to ride from at a friend of the family's. And so I liked it. It had advantages over a tricycle. So I just woke up one morning and tripped over a bicycle that had materialized in the middle of my bedroom overnight. And so I went riding. There were other kids who were riding. In those days, you know, kids were a bit freer to to do things like that. So we did. As far as kind of team sports, I wasn't much of a team player, but that was also by personality. I wasn't into group kinds of activities. I wasn't into, you know, lots of kids yelling and screaming. So I tended to kind of go off more to myself or maybe with a friend, and we would do stuff. These days, I mean, this is fast forwarding a bit, but we have students who are more into ball sports than I am. And we have a student down in Mexico who, well, he was 10 when we worked with him, and he just really took up soccer.
Okay.
He had lost his vision at the age of 6 and was just sort of drummed out of the sport, if you will. And so once he learned how to feel comfortable running around, one of our instructors came up with the idea of just stuffing the ball into a plastic bag. And so when the ball moves, it makes this sort of rustling, crackling sound, which you can follow. And he just became one of the guys, you know, with this idea, and played soccer with the best of them. We had a few students take up basketball. It's generally the ability to just kind of run around on the playground after a ball, which is what kids seem to like to do. One of the things we learned from sports is sportsmanship, which mm-hmm. has to do with team playing, and it has to do with getting along with others and that sort of thing. And the other thing we learned from sports is physicality. Developing our bodies, developing our relationship with our environment, manipulating our environment, and how strongly or quickly can we act upon our environment.
It's pretty powerful.
Well, it was powerful for me, I think, in the sense that I certainly developed physicality. The relationship, the social part of it was not as important to me as a kid, so... I think even that came from something I learned with my parents. I think really one of the most important things I learned from my parents was not that my parents would manage things, would take care of things, would do things, would make things all right. And it was not to count on others, making things all right. It really had to do with me making things all right. I don't know how conscious my parents were of this, but the way I was raised established within me the feeling, the awareness, the view that it was really up to me to make things all right, to make things the way I wanted them to be, and to find the tools, the strategies, the wherewithal to make that happen.
So did that sense of self-accountability make you enhance those skills that you'd been learning as far as your echolocation and whatnot, that whole spatial awareness aspect?
I think that was critical because it meant that I had to develop a good, strong relationship with space, with mm-hmm. my surroundings. And because I wasn't a particularly social kid, to be honest, it was... It was very much up to me. I mean, I didn't tend to hang around people who were going to make that happen on my behalf. So in my case, I think it was essential. Now there are lots of ways to direct oneself and to direct one's life and to direct the course of events around oneself. There are lots of ways to do that. My way of doing it took the form of this spatial awareness and this physical relationship with my environment.
Going back a little bit here, you sort of said at the age of 6 or 7, you got onto a bicycle. I take it that at that point, you'd been climbing trees and walking and probably a bit of running and whatnot. How did the added speed factor involved with riding a bike help you enhance that whole spatial awareness or echolocation tool?
Well, I was a runner as a kid, and so I did run around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for one thing, it was a natural strategy to click faster. you know, you're moving faster, you click faster, you need more spatial updating. So fortunately, that was natural. I mean, it's real interesting. That would seem intuitive, but It isn't necessarily. We've had kids who, you know, doing well with their echolocation lessons, and they have a good strategy and they find their way around. They're doing okay, and you get them on a bicycle, and they become this sort of, you know, yahoo who is just whooping and hollering, and they're not clicking, you know, and they're riding at speed. And I just scratch my head thinking, okay, why would you make that particular choice? It'd be like putting a sighted kid on a bicycle and having them close their eyes as they barrel down the road. It doesn't make sense, but it happens.
Yeah.
And I guess you learn one of two things. You learn either to click, or you learn not to ride your bike.
Yeah.
But in my case, I clicked, and that came quite naturally to me. So I think I found that a rapid movement doesn't have to be running super fast. I mean, it can be a good, healthy walking speed. Really seems to lend itself to understanding what's around you and what your relationship with your environment is. Things seem to pop, if you will. So things around you seem to pop better if you're moving at a rate of speed that isn't a crawl.
Mm-hmm.
When I first began student teaching as a mobility specialist, I was accustomed to my own rate of speed, and I began working with my students who often, but not always, were quite reduced in their way of rate of speed. And I found at first that it was hard for me to maintain my own orientation at that rate of speed. It was a bit of a joke. You know, I had to just really recalibrate my own awareness as I worked with some of these students. So yes, so I found that things around me tended to sort of, they seemed accentuated somehow as I moved faster.
So there was like a clarity?
Yeah, everything became more clear.
And obviously you had quite a good belief in the idea that if you fell off or crashed, you'd get up and brush yourself off and do it again.
Yeah, well, there were a fair number of those. I guess I didn't seem to mind that. Again, it comes back to physicality. I didn't seem mm-hmm. to mind that that aspect of growing up and crashing or falling or, you know, tumbling over things. I mean, like, I was a rough and tumble kid, so you rough and tumble, you get hurt. But there was also a balance, fortunately, between my not minding rough and tumble and my going out of my way to seek out those compromising, comfortable circumstances. I wasn't exactly a daredevil, you know. I wasn't really that kind of kid. I appeared to be, I think, and I've been called a risk taker. I'm a calculated risk taker, I guess. I mean, right. I like to know what my variables are. I like to know what my own capacities are. And it's true even when I went hiking. I mean, I did get lost on my first self hike. But you know, that was not for lack of planning and you know, taking certain steps to make sure that I'd be all right. I had the gear and equipment that I needed for an overnight if I wasn't able to find my way back by evening. And I had a strategy. And I began my hike in an area that I was already familiar with, having hiked it with others.
Okay.
So I built upon a foundation of familiarity, and I built in some safeguards.
So you can have faith in your own abilities rather than having a death wish as such.
That's exactly it. I have no death wish whatsoever. And I'm not a huge fan of pain either. I mean, I have a high pain threshold, but I'm not the kind of person who seeks it out. I like to think that I take care. As a kid, yeah, you know, you go through your boyhood and your teenage years and maybe you have less concern about consequences, but I think I had enough concern about consequences to keep me relatively preserved.
That strength or self-belief must put you in pretty good stead for, you know, growing up into adulthood.
It prepared me for really being able to push out into the world. We don't really live in a world that that goes out of its way to be helpful. We live in a world that just sort of is what it is, and you just sort of find your place in it, or make your place in it. And I don't necessarily think the world goes out of its way to be hurtful either. Again, I think it just sort of is what it is, and it's neither friend nor foe, but I mean, you can make friends with the world. I mean, you can. One of the things I like to tell people is there's nothing inherently unfriendly or dangerous about an environment or about a situation. The unfriendliness or danger that can arise has a lot to do with our choices, has a lot to do with our choices based on the information we have.
Yep. How do you find people's sense of protectiveness for themselves or for their loved ones? Do you find that to be a barrier between people sort of actually getting ahead or getting beyond what their current belief system allows them to do?
Well, blindness does seem to pop a red flag up over your head. You're often not really looked upon as someone with the same human qualities as others. You know, you're somehow extra special, you're extra fragile, there's extra concern, there's extra worry. If you take a tumble, there's somehow more concern that you've taken a tumble than there would be of a sighted child taking the same tumble. And I've seen that play out. I mean, I've seen direct comparisons of, it's kind of like A or B. You know, on the left, you have a blind child who runs into something. On the right, you have a sighted child who runs into something. How do people react? People invariably react very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents didn't, I don't think. And so I'm always perplexed when I see it. It's almost like a social experiment or something. I think the major barriers, or I should say factors, the major factors are social. They're not physical so much. There are things that are more conducive for a blind person to do than not. I mean, you know, you sort of pick your sport, your activity, your environment, your interests, just like anyone else. And I just didn't have a big interest as a kid in silent projectiles. But those who are into team sports, I mean, more power to them. And with some of the strategies and techniques that we've developed with like the ball in the bag, for example, or making some adaptations to the environment, or with certain technologies that we have available nowadays that we didn't then, you can add to that repertoire. You can really, really push those limits, which we kind of like to do, to see what you come up with. You know, so for us, there are a lot of things you can do in sports or otherwise through the support of others to help you do it. You know, you can do cross country, you can run with someone, you can play a lot of sports if your team is you know, has kind of included you in a certain way. And I think that's fascinating, and I think it's fascinating to observe. The question we have as we, and by we I mean World Access for the Blind, as we kind of move forward with our approach and developing and refining the approach is what can a blind person do? What can a blind person accomplish without that kind of support? So that's kind of where we go with it. And I think that comes out of, again, kind of the approach that I took as a kid. It's extending that approach to what can we do when we really develop our own perceptions, when we really develop our own self-efficacy. And then, you know, you can add support in whenever you want, whenever you need it. But what are our capacities without that support? So as a kid, that's how I spent a lot of my time. If I found a tree, I was likely to climb it whether or not others around me could do so, because it was just, it was the kind of personality I had, and it was just the way I looked at things.
Excellent. How do your educational programs work? What are the stages that people progress through?
We look at what people are doing, how people relate to their environment. In the case of children, we look at what seems to be supporting their development and what seems to be inhibiting their development. I'm a developmental psychologist by training, so I look very hard at development, how development is unfolding for a child. So in most cases, we dramatically reduce the amount of guiding that is taking place. It's almost always overdone.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say that we're anti-guiding. Guiding has its place like everything else, but there is a balance here. It has to do with development of one's own perceptual awareness and perceptual capacity. And like anything, the brain strengthens according to how it's used. The brain's like a muscle. It'll grow as it's used. And so the more guiding that takes place, the more those perceptual capacities become disrupted or compromised. And so in order to activate those perceptual capacities, you have to reduce the amount of proxy perceiving, I like to call it, mm-hmm. that's going on. You have to. So once you've done that, and once you've activated or reactivated those perceptual capacities, then you can make choices about what your supports are and how they're managed, really more from a position of power than a position of need. And the other issue related to that for us is the idea of self-directed interaction. So in so many cases, when a person is supported or when a person is guided, that decision has been made by others. Of when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen is made by others. It's dictated by others. And the expectation is that you'll respond, you know, compliantly to those dictates. And we just assume short circuit that whole process and really put the blind student in the driver's seat when it comes to how they're going to manage, well, everything,
mm-hmm.
including support. And we like to see that happen as soon as possible. I mean, as is age appropriate, we like to see it happen with infants and toddlers. There's no reason why your relationship to your world needs to be dictated by others. It can be supported by others, again, as is age appropriate, but that's a different thing. We find that just shifting those foundations, once you've done that, the rest of it just falls into place, more or less. I mean, the approach that we have to helping blind students find their freedom of movement and freedom of choice, it almost teaches itself once you establish those foundations of self-efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
That is generally where we start, and then we move into, if you're looking at the flash sonar bit is you're learning to find easy things before you learn to find hard things, and you learn to find simple things before you learn to find complex things. So we'd start with panel exercises and people learn how to find an object that's placed around them, around their head. And that doesn't usually take very long. And then you extend that to things in your more extended environment as you move. And then how you start establishing those spatial relationships at greater and greater distances and with more and more complexity. We're also cane trainers, so a big part of our work is a perceptual basis for cane training. The cane is usually lengthened, so we fit students with a cane that we call it the body length cane or full length cane.
Okay.
A full length cane doesn't have to be super, you know, duper mega long. And this is kind of a general rule, but the idea is that the cane tip should land at a point that is equivalent to one body length, your body length, away from you as you step. So, you know, foot to tip would be roughly one body length. And we have found through just lots and lots of experimentation and a bit of science that formula seems to engender an almost instinctual readiness for the cane. And it doesn't matter what age, you know, you can put a cane in the hands of a child who isn't even walking yet. And they'll walk sooner, they'll walk faster, they'll walk earlier.
Wow.
When they have this thing at hand. And that's sort of the magic number. I've looked for years for that magic number. And the magic number seems to be roughly one's body length. And I think that kind of makes sense because one of the references of measure in our brain that's instinctive and innate to just about everyone, just about all the time, is your own body length. The brain doesn't necessarily think in terms of feet and inches. You have to teach it that. But innate to the brain is measurement according to your own body length.
Mm-hmm.
And humans are oddly proportioned that way. You know, we are the same from fingertip to fingertip as we are from head to feet. You know, so if you're using your arms, if you're using your arms as a haptic perceptual tool, it kind of makes sense that you'd capitalize on this body length reference. And yes, that seems to be the magic ticket to making this happen. Other things like reducing reliance on physical surfaces, reducing tactile reliance on physical surfaces. It runs counterintuitive to how blind kids tend to be taught with trailing and you know, following surfaces and things like that. And we tend to disrupt that whole process because we find that it tends to develop this dependency on physical surfaces. And the reality is that the world's made up of open space mostly. So if you don't have a comfortable relationship with open space, you're just not going to be able to navigate very well. So that's another area of our. We kind of call it the freedom formula. That's another area of our freedom formula.
Right. Now, during this process, you must see some fairly sort of comical or funny moments. Can you sort of recall some of those in relation to either sport or physical activities?
You know, a lot of it really has to do with, if you're working with kids, it has a lot to do with parental responses. I've had this happen. I've had this happen twice. And it was almost the same scenario played out twice, where we had a young child. They were both boys in this case, roughly similar ages. One of them was 4, the other one was 5. Provided them with a cane, showed them a little bit about how to use it, and then you're chatting with the mom, or the mom is chatting with someone, and the mom looks down, and her child is gone.
Yeah.
Not there. And what's really interesting to observe is this real kind of shocked double take that the mother will do, because that's never happened. Their blind kid doesn't just run off, you know. It has never just taken off in an unfamiliar environment. They'll usually just kind of hang around because they don't have a way to take off. They don't have a way to go somewhere. And so now you've given a child a very simple means of getting somewhere, and they're gone. They're off. They go, and so now you're frantically casting about to find your child. I mean, I guess others might not find that funny. I find that quite funny because it really flies in the face of these conditioned perceptions that both the parent and the child had about how a blind person relates to their world. And all you do is fit them with a stick that you could have just as easily grabbed off a tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that hard, and off they go. And, you know, so, for me, that was, those kinds of experiences are priceless. There was another kind of a funny thing that happened. This was with a boy a bit older, maybe 10. He was a very sporty kid, very sporty, very physical. His physicality was pretty highly facilitated. So very social chap and very, very, you know, well included by his friends and family and so forth. And so he always was with someone and they did stuff together. And so he was also a climber, among other things. I had worked with him for a couple of days, and we were at a park. The mom was there, and she and I are chatting, and the boy's up a tree, and he's gotten up this tree, and he's gotten out on a branch, and he's now hanging from this branch above us. And he's pretty high, you know, 6-7 meters in the air or so. He's just kind of hanging there. And his mom goes, she goes, you know, you're really high. You're really high. You really, really need to be careful about that. And so I said, why don't you click at the ground and give us an idea of how high you think you are? And he did that. And his reaction was actually quite shocked. He just had never thought about it. He'd never thought about what the distance between him and the ground might actually be.
Right.
And yep. when he clicked, he just went, ah, you know, he had this funny reaction to how high he was. And it gave us all a bit of a laugh when, you know, when he had that reaction.
Again, it's that whole perspective change, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was a big, massive change in everyone's perspective. But in his case, it was now being in touch with his surroundings in a manner that he really hadn't been before, and being able to make choices around that are his choices, and not predicated upon how other people think he should choose.
Yeah. What would be some of the biggest challenges that you face?
Oh, the biggest challenges are always people. People, people's attitudes, people's perspectives, people's prejudices, people's biases, and our own. I think the biggest challenge is facing the boundaries of our box, the parameters of our box. And that box is formed much more by social impositions than physical ones. And that's just by far the biggest. It's easy to teach a person how to navigate. That's not hard. That really isn't that hard. I could teach a monkey how to use a cane. I've taught a dog how to use echolocation. It's not that difficult. I've taught, you know, the youngest child we taught effective cane training, are months old.
Wow.
Many kids under two, many toddlers under four. It's just not that hard. The hardest bit is always the social piece. It's always what other people think. It's always how we've been conditioned, or how other people are conditioned, to both support and allow the unfolding of one's own autonomy, of one's own freedom, of one's own self-direction. People just really have a hard time. And it's not just with blind children. I think parents in general these days seem to have a much harder time fostering autonomy. We just want kids to be compliant, and we want and need to be able to structure them and schedule them and tell them what to do and how to do it. And it just engenders executive dysfunction, really, is what it engenders in kids. And so with blind kids, it's particularly devastating because, you know, a sighted person who's executively dysfunctional, they still grow up in a world that's designed for them, pretty much. I mean, you've got a lot of options and choices being a sighted person in a world that's been designed by sighted people, for sighted people. But if you're blind and you're executively dysfunctional, you've got a hard go of it when you get out there. So that sense of executive function versus executive dysfunction, how does one manage one's own relationship to one's environment, one's awareness, to one's activities? How does one govern one's own activities? How does one exercise freedom of choice? That's all about executive function or dysfunction. That's so much socially determined.
Yeah.
And so that's the biggest challenge.
Now, do you have a favorite saying or personal quotation that means something to you?
One of the most powerful ones, or at least one of the ones that seems to be regarded as the most powerful, people seem to like it, is running into a pole is a drag, but never being allowed to run into a pole is a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Physical injuries heal fast, and if you're a kid, they heal quite fast. But those psychological injuries, they don't heal. They get worse. They just get worse. They don't heal in the same way as physical injury. The psychological injuries that result from never being allowed to run into a pole, those are difficult to heal. Those are very difficult to address. And you know, that kind of sums up the basic principle of hands-off instruction. Not that we, you know, not that we put our position, our students in positions of running into poles all the time, but the sentiment is, how do you manage your own relationship with those poles? That's up to you. We'll show you how to do it. We'll teach you how to do that. But at the end of the day, it's how you do it. That saying, that quote, if you will, is kind of our approach in a nutshell.
Cool. What would you say to anybody who's a little bit apprehensive or possibly thinking about learning some of these sort of echolocation or spatial awareness skills? What would your words of encouragement be to that person?
One of the questions I ask students and or parents is how much freedom do you want? How much freedom do you want your child to have? I think of it in terms of freedom. I think of it in terms of freedom of movement, freedom of choice, freedom of establishing one's relationships. Once people have that sense of freedom, of that sense of an answer to their freedom, then we work toward that. The way is open.
I mean, how big a gift is freedom? That's massive.
It is massive, and it's interesting. I mean, I'll just kind of tell this story. I was at the No Barriers Summit. We have Eric Weinmeier has this runs a No Barrier company, or he used to run it. Now someone else runs it. But every year or two, they have a summit, and it's all about, well, all kinds of disability and removing barriers to activity and function. And so it is what you'd think a summit would be. It's a convention of people who come, and they have things to sell, and they have clinics, and you know, anyone's welcome, and people just have a big time of it. Well, I was invited to speak to the No Barriers University, which is sort of the you know, education edification forum that they have. And I think they select 5 or 6 of their clinic providers to come and give a little presentation about what they do. Great stuff. Fantastic stuff. I mean, there are people out there who, you know, really kind of put me to shame in terms of, you know, printing prosthesis in 3D printers and then, you know, taking them to third world countries. I mean, it's like, okay, who figured out how to do that exactly? You can disease control, stuff like that, hunger control. I mean, all the things we think of in the world, disease, hunger, child safety, thirst, famine, all important issues. What's interesting, so I get up on stage and I think, okay, how am I going to compare to this sort of thing? You know, we've eradicated a certain disease from a whole region of the planet. Like, how do I compare with that? And I don't know that I do necessarily, but what's very important to me is something that's commonly overlooked, and it's something as simple as personal freedom. It's freedom of movement. It's freedom of relating to your own environment on your own terms. It's freedom of choice and freedom to exercise one's own choices. And that's something that affects an awful lot of people in various ways, but it certainly affects blind people. And it's something that is so often denied or rejected or withheld intentionally or unintentionally, consciously or unconsciously, or a combination of both, from blind people everywhere. And people don't think about freedom of movement because it just comes so naturally to people, and you just expect that all people have it somehow. But not all people have it, and not all people are allowed it. And that's a pretty basic thing. I mean, to me, that's about as basic as food. You know, it's about as basic as being able to have a good night's sleep. It's about as basic as having camaraderie and companionship. But somehow we tend to overlook that.
It's a very impressive gift to be able to share. And you obviously must feel very humbled or in what you do. And the rewards must be huge.
It is very humbling. That's actually a good way of putting it. It is very humbling. I mean, the whole enormity of it is humbling.
How can people find out more about what you do, Daniel?
Well, our website, worldaccessfortheblind.org. So World Access for the Blind is one word, all spelled out, .org. We are a non-government organization.
Brilliant. Daniel Kish, thank you so much for joining us. That's been amazing. And thank you for sharing your knowledge and experience.
It was delightful. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Blind Sport Podcast with Mike Lloyd, the sports show that's dedicated to blind sport.
It's time for a motivational quotation that just makes you want to say,
yeah!
Okay, a few quotations. There is no question that the objects that surround us impact our experience of the world. Immerse yourself amongst the doers, and soon you will find yourself doing too. He who didn't succeed at his own dreams was too busy listening to another's failures. Decide to dream big dreams and make them happen. Never let procrastination or excuses squeeze your dreams to become small. Do it early and do it big. The best athletes in the world are those who are willing to push harder than anyone else and go through more pain than anyone else. I hope you enjoyed our chat with Daniel about the technique of echolocation and how it could make a difference in the way that you approach sport. A huge thank you to Daniel for sharing his experience and knowledge with us. If you use echolocation to help you with your specific sport, then please do email me and tell me all about it. If you have a story or you know of a person that would be great to feature on a future show, then please do contact me and let's make it happen. Likewise, if you have any comments or opinions on the show, then do fire me off an email, mike@theblindsportpodcast.com. Very cool.
To contact Mike or comment on the Blind Sport Podcast,
submit a feedback form from the website theblindsportpodcast.com.
Email mike@theblindsportpodcast.com.
Send a tweet or follow us on Twitter @BlindSportMike.
Or visit the Blind Sport Podcast page on Facebook.
Aha! Excellent!
To assist me with the growth of the Blind Sport Podcast, I need your help. If you know of others who may get value from listening to this show, then please do tell them about it. Tell your friends, your family, your club members, your work colleagues, whether it be face-to-face or via social networks, let's get the word out there. If we do this together, we can promote the awareness of blind sports and make a difference. Okay, that's us for another episode. So train hard, play fair, give it your all, and most importantly, enjoy your sport. Thanks for listening. Take care. See ya.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Blind Sport Podcast, the sports show that's dedicated to blind sport with Mike Lloyd. Visit theblindsportpodcast.com.